To better your best and your world, you need to dig deep and grow. Join us as top experts, leaders, and creators uncover powerful insights to help you grow in life and in work. And now, your host, Michael McAvoy. Welcome, everybody, to this edition of Dig Deep Grow, the show dedicated to helping you better your best and your world. We're going to take a little bit of a tack that's different from what we normally do. We're going to talk a little about our country, and one of the biggest challenges facing our country happens to be the debt that we have built up over generations, and this has to be addressed sometime, and I think that we need to bring some smart people up to discuss it and to bring it out so that we can hopefully come to a resolution. Because right now, tens of trillions of dollars of debt do not seem to be being addressed in our present environment. So joining us today is Ed Kleinbard, and he's just completed a new book called We Are Better Than This, How Government Should Spend Our Money. And I'm going to allow Ed to get into the premise of the book, but my understanding is that Ed's approach is different from what we've come to, you know, be familiar with, you know, people arguing about spending and taxation, political parties going at each other that way. So it's going to be an interesting look, maybe provide a new insight for people to think about. So, Ed, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks very much for having me on, Michael.
So, Ed, tell me about the book and the premise that you bring that approaches this issue differently.
Yes, let me do that. Let me say at the outset that our national debt is a long-term issue, but it's not a short-term crisis, no matter how it might be portrayed. The fact is we have plenty of capability of raising revenue sufficient to pay down national debt to levels that would be appropriate long-term, and also to sustain the government that we need. What we really need to do is to focus on what it is that we ask of government. And so the purpose of the book is to reset how we think about the fundamental government activities of taxing and spending, what you call fiscal policy, and to suggest that we basically, in most of our arguments, so put the cart before the horse. We spend an awful lot of time arguing about taxes, and that's crazy. The business that government is in, beyond the narrow police functions, is to invest and ensure for the greater welfare of all of us. And government does that through its spending, not through its taxing. Taxing is just how we finance the business that government is in.
Mm-hmm.
So when we argue about taxes and say that this is the maximum amount of taxes we are going to collect as a percentage of our national income, our GDP, we're really acting like the Greek mythological figure Procrustes, who would invite people in to spend the night, and when they got into the bed, he would chop off their legs if they were too big, or stretch them if they were too small to fit his bed. And that's exactly what we do when we start with tax, and then try to figure out how much we have to spend. What we need to do instead is to look at the real business of government, which is the business of investing in all of us. In insuring, look at the financial returns from that, look at the larger social returns from that, and then say, here are all of these opportunities. How much of those opportunities can we afford, given that the investments themselves are throwing off large positive returns, which is the missing piece that people neglect in their thinking.
Okay, yeah. So what I hear you saying is that there's a financial investment and people investment. And what I'd like you to do is frame where we are now, give your summary of how we're presently spending our money, how we're presently investing for our country, and where it should be, where what we should be doing.
Sure. So today we all have this impression that the United States is a high tax, big government country, and of course that's just not true. The United States, in fact, and now I'm including federal, state, and local taxes, the United States today is the lowest taxed country in the OECD, the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, which is sort of the association of all the major developed economies around the world. We are the lowest taxed country in the OECD as a percentage of our GDP. And so this is one of the big points. In we are better than this. One of the big points is to say we are a low-tax country and we are starving ourselves by not making the kinds of investments that we should. And I go through this in great detail in a long chapter called Our Dismal Report Card, in which I show that by lots of measures, whether it's investment in public education, whether it's investment in physical infrastructure, building roads, bridges, so on, the United States does much less than most other countries as a percentage of our national income. And the result is that we are beggaring our own future, which is a very weird thing for the richest large country in the world to be doing.
Okay.
Our educational results are terrible. There are only two places where we spend more than average. One of them is in military, where we spend a great deal more, however measured, than any other country in the world. In absolute terms, in terms of percentage of GDP, in terms of per capita, we spend more per capita than Israel does, which is fine. I'm not quarreling with that, but then you got to pay for it by raising revenues for that and revenues for investing that throw off financial returns. And the other place, of course, is healthcare, where we have for decades had the most inefficient healthcare system in the world.
Let me play devil's advocate for a moment. You mentioned one area is education. My understanding is that we are presently paying per pupil about $13,000 a year through government funding. And yet, since the 1970s, the SAT scores have actually dropped among nationally. So, you can make comparisons from the U.S. to different countries, but you also have to, you know, look at the return on what we're doing internally here. So, take education as an example. Why would you argue for increased spending in this area when we just haven't seen the returns that we're looking for?
Well, first, there's no way to know in the abstract whether $13,000 is a big number or a small number. One of the reasons for benchmarking the United States against other countries, which I do a lot in We Are Better Than This, is to try to give a sense of where we are relative to others, so we have a sense of whether we're spending too little or too much. There's no doubt that public education could be like anything else, could always be made more effective. But the fact is that one of the reasons for these lower test scores is a fundamental misapplication of our dollars in public education. The United States is one of four countries in the OECD. I mean, we're keeping company with Latvia and Turkey in investing more in rich kids than in poor kids, which is actually quite perverse. If you want to talk about SAT scores, if you want to talk about the country as a whole, you should do what all the other major industrial countries do, which is to recognize that we should invest more in poor kids because they don't have other resources available to them. So right from birth, we actually have recent studies that demonstrate that undernutrition, not severe malnutrition, but undernutrition leads to lower cognition for a lifetime, We have abundant evidence of early childhood nutrition and education is super important in setting kids on the right path. And we know that kids with rich parents get 7 times the enrichment spending. Now, I'm not talking about private schools. I'm talking about after-school cello lessons. Mm-hmm. 7 times the enrichment that provided to kids from poor families. So if you want to look at why public education is failing, the fundamental issue is we have a lot of poor Americans. We don't like to admit it, but we have a lot of poverty in this country. And unlike every other civilized country, we're not investing in those kids. And by doing that, we are dishonoring the fundamental premise of the quality of opportunity. There's no equality of opportunity if other kids who from rich families with all of their connections are also getting more public funding in their education, plus enrichment and so on.
Isn't it true, though, that all children, at least theoretically, in a public school system have equal opportunity with regards to programs?
Absolutely not. It's absolutely not true because we fund public education in many parts of the country, mm-hmm. in most parts of the country, at a local level. And the result is that the amount spent per pupil, which sounds very high, is high in wealthy neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. There's a direct connection between the wealth of a neighborhood and the spending per pupil in public education. So what you see in the national average numbers is that rich communities, where affluent Americans have banded together, spend a great deal on public education, and poor communities, because public education in most areas is locally funded, mm-hmm. spend much, much less on public education.
Right. Get this podcast delivered to you automatically. You can subscribe via iTunes, Stitcher, and more. You'll find the links here or on our website, digdeepgrow.com. Okay. So why don't you zoom out a little and looking at the economy as a whole, and you know, I like the idea of focusing a little bit, or for the future, on this whole education question, because after all, our children are the future for our country.
Exactly.
So what I'd like you to do is paint where you fit or where you stand in the debate of, hey, we have to balance the budget, we have to live within our means, or, you know, we have to spend what we need to on social programs and other things like that in order to make this a better country to live in. Where do you come in?
I am on the progressive end on the issues of spending, and that's the reason one of the reasons I wrote We Are Better Than This, because I know that it is a counterintuitive place to be from the point of view of a lot of Americans who have a false impression that we're up against the ceiling, that we've got to tighten our belts. This is just not true. If we simply went back to the same tax rate environment that we had when Bill Clinton was president, and we all thought the future looked great, and we all managed somehow to show up for work and perfectly okay with the tax structure then in place, we would, by that alone, raise enough revenue to address any deficit issues. The reason for our deficit issues is not that that spending is out of control. It's that we're strangling ourselves by imposing artificially low numbers on the amount of tax we collect. I mean, let me give you an example. Federal income tax collections for the years leading up to the Great Recession were in the order of magnitude of 18.5% of GDP for a 50-year average. In the last few years, during the recession, we were collecting as little as 15.5%. Well, 3% of GDP is half a billion dollars. Half a trillion dollars.
Okay.
When you look at fundamental issues like equality of opportunity, and also when you look at the simple fact that government investment throws off real economic returns. When we build a bridge, we get richer, and those returns have been measured frequently 8% and 10% a year. when we look at all of these opportunities, what we actually need is a more muscular government. And by doing that, we're going to have a more prosperous future. And we're also going to have a future that is not constrained by the terrible specter of the income inequality problems that we face today.
Okay. So it sounds to me as if, I mean, if we have a, I don't know how many it is in terms of trillions, but when you look at funded and unfunded obligations in our government, how much does that come to?
Well, I could the official national debt that is held by the public is in the order of magnitude of $10.5 or $11 trillion right now, which is 65 or 70% of GDP, which is the right way to look at it. The absolute numbers don't really work because our economy grows, we have a little bit of inflation, so you always have to talk in percentages of GDP.
Okay.
That's the order of magnitude.
That's a fair way of looking at it. I've heard now, I don't know which economist it was, but that when you go past a certain percentage of GDP, I think it was 80%, that in the history of the world, that it always leads to some sort of a failure in the economic system. And I'll ask you to address that. I know that, for instance, Japan has a very high percentage. It's over 100%. And you could, if you know the historical record on this, maybe you could just answer
yeah,
that.
Yeah, and while you were asking the question, Michael, I was able to look up the exact number. And our debt right now is about $12.7 trillion. So that's about, that's a little over 70% of GDP.
Okay.
Well, yes, there was a very influential paper a number of years ago that made the claim that you just suggested, but it turns out that there were some major flaws in that paper,
mm-hmm.
and the authors have walked it back.
Okay.
What we know is this. We know that some national debt is not problematic, and very large amounts of national debt are problematic because relative to GDP in every case, because they constrain what government can do, particularly in cases of national emergency. But there's no cliff. There is a slope, but there is no cliff. And I think most economists would conclude that national debt in the range of 50% of GDP is a perfectly safe place to be. But basically, it's the same as business. The question has to be, in every case, do you have the earnings capability to service the debt? The same way a business would say, how much debt should I have? Well, you know, enough to do the business I need to do, but not so much that I can't service it in good times and bad.
Okay.
The United States is the richest large economy in the world, and we are, in fact, have a very large debt service capacity in the sense of what the tax base could collect. We have the lowest tax collections in the world as a percentage of GDP of major developed countries, and we therefore confuse things and think, therefore, we have a debt crisis when we really have a tax collection crisis. We're just not taxing ourselves enough. We're not taxing ourselves enough for the government we actually want today. And we're not taxing ourselves for the government we need. All of our money today goes to basically to the largest military in the world by any measure, to the most inefficient healthcare system in the world, which has nothing to do with the Affordable Care Act. It's been the most inefficient for decades. And to the elderly. We spend a lot of money relative to our entire government spending on the elderly. But it's not because we're overspending on the elderly. It's because we're underspending on everybody else.
Okay. All right. So it's what you're laying out is really a classic debate that we've had, which is the 99% versus the 1%.
I disagree with that. I understand the point.
Let me finish the question, and you can address it.
Okay.
What I meant by that is that we have a certain amount of money that we're spending publicly. You said previously that it's, in the case of education, it's a disproportionate amount going toward the more well-off than the poor. So what I'm saying in that question is, it's really about redistributing the money in a more fair fashion. Is that accurate?
Well, no, I really resist the use of the word redistribution. I think it's an odious term, and it's an odious term for the reason that we were just starting to get into, which is it implies this class warfare kind of mentality of them versus us, whether it's 1% and 99% or however you slice it,
right,
that there are makers and takers, and the only question is how much will the takers take from the makers. That's a false way of thinking. The fact is, again, you start from the point of view, which is true, which is demonstrably true, that government investment in things like infrastructure throw off big positive returns.
Mm-hmm.
We are investing essentially zero net of depreciation in infrastructure today.
Mm-hmm.
Investing in ourselves through education throws off huge positive returns,
mm-hmm.
and we as individuals, as human beings, are the largest asset class in the United States. So investing in ourselves is not a question of redistribution. It's a question of simply making smart investments with big positive returns. Those returns mean the pie gets bigger. Not that we're slicing it differently, but that the pie gets bigger. And it's also the case that those kinds of returns are returns that in which everyone participates. So the country as a whole gets richer. The country as a whole, the middle class does better. But it's not doing better because we're redistributing. It's doing better because we're investing in ourselves in ways that benefit all of us. And when you look net, and this is an important point in the book, when you look at the net of government taxing and spending, put them together, government spending programs are inherently quite progressive. They benefit the benefits of government spending, whether it's a new bridge or public education, are shared more equally than is the extraordinary inequality in incomes today. So everyone needs to invest more in ourselves. The pie will get bigger, and the returns from that larger pie will be shared more equitably.
Okay, so you just mentioned, this is a concrete example, that you could have different areas of the economy that will give you a better return. So infrastructure was one, and education is another. Can you paint a picture for where we should be putting our financial resources in order to, you know, make the pie bigger, as you say?
Right. Well, infrastructure, as I said, is an easy case because right now, in the old days, we used to spend about 3%, a couple decades ago, during the Reagan years, during the Bush 1 years, we used to spend about 3% of GDP on public investment in infrastructure, net of the wear and tear on the existing infrastructure. And now we're down to about 0.5% of GDP. We're down to one-sixth as much spending that we used to do. When you spend on infrastructure, you make air travel or car travel or train travel faster. More efficient. You open opportunities for transport for neighborhoods that now become accessible for commuting that weren't before. Those kinds of returns can be measured in financial terms, and they have very high returns, 8-10% at a time when governments can borrow at 2-3%. Then on top of that, you create lots of good quality jobs. We're not going to have everyone in America working as a Silicon Valley software engineer.
Mm-hmm.
You create good quality jobs. And I believe that what distinguishes the United States, ultimately, is that we define ourselves through work. And what we need in this country are good quality jobs that people are proud of, to make them feel good about themselves and give them the financial resources necessary to lead a satisfying life.
Well, yeah, I think
you know what? Construction does that.
Yeah, the jobs picture as it currently is, is a pretty sore spot. I think you're right.
Well, we
used to do better.
We were a couple of years ago. Unemployment is at the lowest level, in several years. We've made tremendous progress from, the collapse of the economy in 2008. So we've actually made a good deal of progress, and a lot of the jobs that were lost, of course, were lost in government. And now, when you go and the Motor Vehicles Bureau isn't open 2 days a week because they don't have the staffing, well, we all pay the cost of that.
Okay. Now, you've mentioned the return on investment we can get from certain areas by investing in certain areas. That unless we're just going to, open up the spigot for more money via taxation, which we may have to do, but if you were going to reduce spending in other areas of the economy that are not providing a good return, what are some of those areas?
Well, healthcare is by far the largest example. We spend close to double as a percentage of GDP of what many other large countries do that have healthcare outcomes that are better than ours. It's quite depressing to see how much money we waste on healthcare, and this has nothing to do with Obamacare. The criticism of the Affordable Care Act should have been it didn't do enough, but we're spending 18% of GDP on healthcare. Other countries are spending 9 and 10%.
Mm-hmm.
So that number by itself is extraordinary. We essentially spend as much as other countries do from public spending on healthcare, mm-hmm. and then we spend exactly the same amount all over again in private spending on healthcare. And of course, that's like taxing ourselves, because from your point of view, your survival is kind of an existential imperative, and the result is you take your health very seriously. So our healthcare system is the problem is probably the largest single fiscal problem. You want lower taxes and leaner government and more money in your pocket, then you should have voted for a single-payer health system like every other major economy in the world has.
Right.
That simple.
Okay. So without going, on a big tangent on healthcare, what would you say is the number one reason why we have such bigger budget for healthcare than versus, as you said, the other countries in the world?
Because we are spitting into the wind of the fundamental laws of insurance. Insurance is an extraordinarily useful financial tool. It takes the financial risk of big adverse events, adverse fortuities, they call them, and reduce it to a small, consistent cost from year to year in the form of the insurance premium. But to make that work, you have to address one of the two fundamental problems of insurance, which is the problem that they call of adverse selection, which means that people who volunteer for insurance tend to have a reason to think that they're going to want it. And so the way to get health insurance at a reasonable cost is to say, look, we're not going to let you just bleed to death on the streets. We don't live in the Stone Age. We have, in fact, a public safety net in the form of emergency rooms and so on. So let's get serious about the fact that we have a public system. Let's get serious about the fact that Medicare is public, that Medicare is not, in fact, funded by your Medicare taxes. It requires a lot of extra money from general tax revenues. Let's recognize that the law of insurance says everybody will get, the law of life says everybody will get sick. Everybody will need health care. And the law of insurance says that insurance only works if you get everybody into the insurance pool. Everybody's got to jump hands into the pool. And that's why every other country has some form or other of mandatory national healthcare as the principal delivery mechanism for healthcare in that country. It doesn't have to be exclusive. You can, if you're rich and want to buy yourself more, that's fine. But what you have to have is everybody in the pool. And you have to recognize you're doing that so that the oddball event that befalls a 29-year-old isn't supported out of general tax revenues because he thought he didn't need insurance, and also because the 29-year-old of today will be the 59-year-old of 30 years from now and the 89-year-old of 60 years from now, and he will require insurance.
Mm-hmm.
So by paying today, by being part of the pool today, you are insuring not only people who need it more today, you're insuring yourself in the future by signing on to the system. Every other country has figured this out, and that's the only way to get to a logical place. And then you have to deal with the fundamental meddling of Congress. You know, this country is about the only big country I know of where we're not allowed to, Medicare is not allowed to negotiate a prescription drug prices, for example.
Yeah.
So we vastly overpay for prescription drugs. We subsidize the rest of the world by doing that.
Right. So that it sounds to me like we're going to have some issues just like the one you mentioned, that it's a tug of war between interests. But, you know, if you were going to give a grade, say, to the Affordable Health Care Act as a move in the right direction, what would you give it?
B minus.
Okay.
You know, it did not do enough in moving the needle, but it did it, and it was presented in a way and understood by the population, by many people in a way that made it much more difficult to make further progress. The story of why the Affordable Care Act was so fundamentally misunderstood is a story that needs to be told, but this isn't the time to do it.
Right. Okay. The book is called We Are Better Than This, How Government Should Spend Our Money. I've been talking with Ed Kleinbard, and Ed, I do have one more question for you to try to tie up this interview. It's a very difficult subject, but
yes.
You've done a good job at touching at some of the issues involved. What I'd like you to do is address the idea of, okay, so we've got all these different things we're trying to juggle to try to figure out how to move the country forward. If you could wave a magic wand and go sit with the Congress or the president and say, this is the big three things that we have to do. If we do these, we'll start moving in the right direction. What would you do?
We need to think about fiscal policy as a combination of taxing and spending. We have to stop thinking about this as if somehow the only relevant question is how much pain do we want to inflict on ourselves through taxation, to which everyone's answer is not very much, please. We have to start instead thinking about the fact that taxing is just the way we finance the business the government is in, and we have to start asking the question, what business should government be in? How much should government be delivering of this or that business segment? And then how expensive will it be finance that? And when you look at government from that way, you see opportunities everywhere to get immediate financial returns and opportunities as well to honor the principle of equality of opportunity.
Okay, so that's the spending and taxing. What
right,
else?
Put them together. You have to look at them together.
Okay. What about, what would you say, okay, this is what our budget is now. I think we have to reallocate, rejigger what we're doing here. What would you say then?
Well, the problem with our budget now is that it is bloated in two areas, military and healthcare. We are committed to having an outsized military. That's fine. If that's our national consensus, but then I would insist that we really ought to pay for it. Healthcare, I've already touched on. There's a huge amount that can be done to deliver healthcare more efficiently so that we don't have to pay so much either indirectly through taxes or directly through doctor bills. to deliver better health care at less cost. And then beyond that, it's really a question of growing government, because if you look at how much money we're actually spending as a percentage of GDP on all of our non-defense discretionary spending, we're at the lowest levels in 40 years, and we're trending down by virtue of the sequester and other artificial constraints.
Mm-hmm.
There's no runaway government in this country. There's no runaway spending. There is, in fact, smaller and smaller spending on the part of government that materially changes our lives in our lifetimes, which is non-defense discretionary spending.
Okay. And the last question is, if you could institute one program in this country, in other words, the president says, okay, in order to grow this country, we need to do something big, what would that program be for you?
Well, I think the most immediate is a national infrastructure bank that would finance infrastructure projects, but also grade them, vet them, you know, to try to curb the natural problems of Congress approving foolish a bridge to nowhere type project, and with that, an investment commitment to invest money in the same order of magnitude as we spend, say, on the interstate highway system.
Mm-hmm.
That would create jobs. That would add to our wealth, and we would see the returns on that in short order. So that's the kind of program that would have the most immediate impact on Americans' lives and on the overall health of the economy.
Ed Kleinbard, thank you for joining me today. The book is We Are Better Than This, How Government Should Spend Our Money. It's a huge subject to tackle, but you've done it in your book. It's now out in the market. So if the listeners and viewers, if you'd like to go and explore more, please pick up the book. And Ed, thank you for joining me again today. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.